Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're coming towards a close of our series on the history of English towns, and I want to actually do two things today. I want to both look at the last aspects of the present situation that I wish to engage with. I mean, obviously, it's always easy to point out gaps, but they're all good things have to come to an end. But I also want to talk about the longer term resonance of the series. Let's start with the first. And I was discussing the extent to which concern about crime was an issue, not just concern about crime in the sense that people often think about it, such as, you know, muggings, burglary, the epidemic of mobile phone thefts in London at the present moment, which surely spread elsewhere, but also crime, as we were discussing last time, in other respects, such as the grooming, so-called, misleading word for the brutalization of young women by gangs and so on. So concern about crime in towns certainly played a role in movement from those areas that were perceived as dangerous, both within towns, but also away from them. In the case of within towns, what might to some people be sold as an edgy area was to others particularly concerned about the nature of the environment in the local schools, often seen quite rightly in many respects as highly undesirable. I mean, I can well recall going for a walk from, because I had time, from Lambeth to Herne Hill, and coming across the gentleman who was clearly the local drug dealer on his rounds with 5 escorts, and I thought it prudent to walk in the road as an old fat white guy, not looking not to be beaten up. So you know, there's both movement within towns, but also movement beyond them. And in part, in fact, I think one could refer to an urban flight to the countryside, what in America is often called white flight. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that the aspirational or concerned of all ethnicities are often very keen to move away from areas that are regarded as dangerous or unpleasant. And this was especially marked in the early 2020s, in response both to the COVID pandemic of 2020-2022, in which the cities were closed and people thought that they might be safer in the countryside. And, you know, apparently in Bampton, not so far from here, houses were being bought unseen. And also to what subsequently was the continued way in which people were able to work from away from the office. As a result of that, after the COVID epidemic ended, urban offices, notably in London, became emptier, especially on Mondays and Fridays, with an impact on expenditure on commuting and meals. Indeed, if you walk around the City of London at the present moment, you will notice there are fewer sandwich bars than there were before the COVID epidemic. And if you look at actually the frequency of usage of long distance trains, the pattern has also changed. In 2023 to 2024, there was a partial reaction to the move away from London, in part in response to train strikes, incessant train strikes, which is yet another reminder of the impact of external factors on urban fortunes. And there was a return to London by some who had left it. Nevertheless, COVID and its aftermath has caused a significant impact. In part, this is a matter of a variant on a more general concern and resentment about large towns, particularly London, and a resulting move to smaller settlements elsewhere, whether those settlements are suburban or not. Furthermore, there is still only a partial return to working in the office on Mondays and Fridays, and this, I would suggest, alters the relationship between place of work and place of residence. Both place of work and place of residence are generally part of what is referred to as urban space, or the urban space, but they are so in very different ways, and of course with different demographic and social structures. Alongside crime as a reminder of the varied types of discontent and, in theory, in response to it, the massive spread of CCTV, closed-circuit television, in towns ensured that life was literally under supervision, as well as being more regulated for both poor and wealthy alike. Greater regulation left less space for autonomy or independence, unless permitted by government or indeed criminal. And there was particular concern about restrictions on urban driving, which in some respects were farcical, because if the ostensible reason was to deal with pollution, then actually causing cars to drive slowly in low gears is actually just simply going to increase pollution as well as congestion. If it was an attempt to cause gridlock, that was scarcely desirable. But whatever the rationale, there was a classic example of a mismatch between environmentalism, however portrayed and however presented, and actually the increasingly difficult living standards of much of the population or living circumstances. And I do think that is a point, that last one, that contrast I just drew, is one that's worth thinking about, that actually when we talk about, you know, in elections and more generally in politics, about living standards being the key element, and the assumption being it's how much food you've got to put on the table. In practical terms, that is very important, but so also is what I would call living circumstances. You can have plenty of food on the table, but if you are fearful, if the area where you live is a real effort or chaos to navigate, if you feel that it's not safe to go out in the evenings, and then it's all very well for people of whatever political persuasion to talk about your living standards going up, but your living circumstances might be getting much worse. And I noticed that the new government has spoken more of living standards than of living circumstances. It's very unclear whether it can do much about the former, but it's very clear that it is, in fact, for many, not presumably for everybody, but for many, making the latter worse. And the ease of getting round of an urban space is a classic instance of that. You can raise the minimum wage, which helps a significant number of very poor people. But either if you cause the companies that employ them to go bankrupt, or if you make it very difficult to actually navigate to your job, then this is not such a marvelous outcome. Meanwhile, uneasiness at the past had been shown in 2020, when the statue of Edward Colston was publicly thrown into the harbour in Bristol by a large crowd and without police intervention. This launched a more general criticism of sculptures, attacks on them, and attacks on aspects of the urban townscape, particularly the naming of streets and buildings. Colston himself, a Bristol-born, London-based participant in the slave trade, but principally in Mediterranean trade, was a major philanthropist. But in 2020, St Mary Redcliffe Church in Bristol also removed a stained glass church window dedicated to him. Where Liverpool had made a public apology in 1994 for its role in the slave trade, and etc., etc. You can now scarcely open a newspaper without being aware that what you are told is a conversation about slavery or empire is actually a diatribe, much of which is aimed at the existing nature of society, including its urban infrastructure. The town as a centre for cultural iconography as well as action is being also changed in other respects. So in 2024, the London Overground, the TfL orange lines as used to be on the maps, was renamed with Lioness, Mildmay, Windrush, Weaver, Suffragette and Liberty lines. The line names were deliberately not geographical, as in North London line. That would have been far too convenient and comfortable and readily understood. However, those chosen did not necessarily resonate widely. The Mildmay line was named after a hospital about which little was known, not after the early modern Mildmays. And the Liberty line celebrates the Royal Liberty of Havering, the old name for the borough of Havering. The lines had no reference to railway history, such as the navvies who built the railways, railway works or marshalling yards. But it was part of the use of the urban townscape in order to make a political in the widest sense point. I mean, as in, you know, naming housing blocks after Nelson Mandela and such like. Far more significance can be attached to a bipartisan move, the attempt begun by the Conservative government in 2016 to have elected mayors introduced across all regions of England as part of a new structure of local government that included powers for economic planning. In practice, this measure offered the basis for urban-focused regional government, but has so far created public support for regional government as a whole. I think it's worth thinking about this, since this is the week in which John Prescott died. Prescott, as Deputy Prime Minister under Tony Blair, was a figure who very much supported regional parliaments. And indeed, he was responsible for the referendum held in the first area that was chosen for a parliament, the northeast of England, chosen because it was regarded as the area most likely to support it. It was also the part of England, of course, that was furthest from London, and the part of England that had the strongest experience of a neighbour, to wit Scotland, having regional government and devolution, though the Scots obviously don't see that as regional government. Now, as you will know, the devolution was voted down, and that then in a referendum, and that then was shelved by Labour. I think it's worth bringing out that it was shelved and voted down for the sort of reasons that are still pertinent today. I used to live in Newcastle, and anybody who lived there could have told Mr. Prescott, who knew very little about it, that Newcastle was widely disliked within the Northeast, the same way in which London is widely disliked within the country, that there were other cities, most obviously Sunderland, which felt hard done by, with some justice, by Newcastle, and that there was a small town northeast, places like Alnwick or Morpeth, that didn't wish to see, as it were, an additional burden created. And the perception that regional government would be an additional burden that would not answer to much of its electorate was one that was strongly established. Now, what is interesting is now the process appears to be gathering pace without a comparable mandate. And in fact, I notice in the newspaper today that the new government is proposing to rapidly continue with getting rid of secondary tier local government and having just unitary tier, which is means in practical terms that what one is going to end up with is dominance often by planners and politicos in one-party states, in particular urban areas, with much of the region, as it were, ignored or only able to express itself through an anti-politics, which isn't necessarily particularly attractive at all. So this is part and parcel of a wider atomization of British politics in the sense that it's taking away the nature of a local democracy. And I think that's an important point about this. When the government talks, and this is equally true of the Conservatives, so this is a bipartisan point, when the government talks about devolved parliament powers and such like, what is actually the case is that they are, in a sense, a devolved quasi-dictatorship. That probably is going too far, but a devolved, as it were, nexus of power, which enables the locals to feel that they are often completely and utterly ignored. The councillors are chosen from really quite large areas, which means that somebody who is, or some group that is unhappy about changes to the policing or housing or traffic or whatever in a part of an area that might, when there were secondary tier authorities, have had a role, these no longer are able to do so or will no longer be able to do so. And I think this is part and parcel of a disturbing trend in British politics, which is the sense that of a disjuncture between people and state. Now, one has to be careful here. There has always been elements of the population that feel that they are living in a not democratized state. And in some respects, things like petitions or the internet, social media, people are better able to, whether we like it or not, to express their views. So that, in a sense, means one has to be wary of talking endlessly about a democratic deficit. But in other respects, there clearly is a democratic deficit. Councils are under much less scrutiny than in the past, not least because local newspapers have been hollowed out and there is no real local media that acts as a substitute. I think it's fair to say that the processes of government are often more mindful of legal edicts that are not in any way democratically accountable than they are about the views of the population in whichever area is being legislated for or administered for. And there is this sense of which one can see in declining or low turnouts in elections. There is this sense clearly about by at least a third of the electorate that nobody's particularly interested in them and it's not worth bothering about. Now, that may be a view on national politics or indeed Britain's international position, and we can discuss that, and I'm very happy to do so. I'm here more speaking about the local aspect and the way in which, in much of the country, there is a sense of alienation, not just from the metropolis, which reflects a state that is seen as alien by much of the population elsewhere, a state passing laws and regulations mindful of fashionable opinion or noisy opinion within the M25, but with relatively little backing elsewhere. But it's not only that, but that this process is replicated elsewhere in much of the country. So if you live in North Lancashire, you have to put up with a sort of dominance by Manchester, and so on and so forth. And I think these are problems, and these problems are made more difficult by the situation that this is not one in which people are having the benefits of economic growth to quarrel over, but instead are, as it were, often establishing positions because they are concerned both about economic stasis, if not in per capita terms decline, but also worried about the extent to which the new practice of government, not least with a significant expansion of imposed housing and imposed migration, they're not really happy with the way in which that plays through their local world. So I think that there is an uneasy aspect, and it's one which is manifested differently by individuals, and it's one where it, if one is, you know, makes comments about the danger is that you will be castigated for some reason or other. But obviously, and the same would be true if it was a Conservative government. Obviously, if we have a government that is rests essentially on a relatively modest, let's just put it like that, percentage of the voting population, then it's not surprising that there is widespread disquiet. Decline in the urban space, so-called, meanwhile, was claimed by many who said they would prefer to live in the countryside. That's true repeatedly in polls. However, such a situation is relative, chronologically, geographically, and thematically. We need to bear that in mind. I mean, England's towns remain critical to economic growth and social development as essential and accessible meeting places. However much people also might work from home, most jobs are in urban areas. This necessity, which has become even more relevant post-COVID, has influenced the design, layout, and content of towns, as well as their management and its governments. Get it right and it hums, but get it wrong, and I would suggest, again, bipartisan and the recent trend, and nobody really wants to go there. I mean, you know, it's no accident that Liverpool, of the major urban areas, is the one with the lowest population growth. Humans, after all, I think it's fair to say, are sociable. And of late, there has been a transformation of many town centres from a post-war fixation with shopping centres and car parks, often replacing what had been the industrial workshops earlier, where nobody lived, to more mixed use, high amenity, low carbon neighbourhood clusters. That's the theory, that these should be anchored by civic or cultural buildings and public spaces better served by public transport. But if you cannot get the economic growth to produce this, it remains a planning fantasy. And that is true of much discussion about urban space. Public-private partnerships have played a key role in recent times, as well as more enlightened town planning. But I think it's fair to say that present policies put too much stress, a strain on the private aspects, and the idea that expropriatory state investment control is going to create a nirvana is really something that reflects in many senses the kind of ideas that you saw around, you know, British enthusiasts for the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. And it's worth bearing in mind also, as far as enlightened town planning, so-called, is concerned, that lower dependence on cars doesn't suit all inhabitants. In fact, it's worth bearing in mind that the current fashion for focus, as in London, on cyclists essentially validates the young and the fit. Nothing wrong with that, but buses, of course, which take far more people, are actually becoming steadily slower in London and other cities because of cycle lanes and because of road narrowing. Government needs to explicitly, if it wishes to have a large-scale housing policy, it needs explicitly to join it up with planning and economic planning, not least as counterweights to London, for jobs. And again, that's a necessary aspect of what we're talking about. If it becomes the case that simply London grows and that those people who can't afford it are discounted elsewhere, then that is not going to necessarily be a very attractive prospect. And of course, it will have political consequences. worth bearing in mind that what can displease one generation can be regarded as worthy of saving in another. So if you read Arthur Conan Doyle's short story, The Red-Headed League, a Sherlock Holmes one, of course, which came out in 1891, he focuses on the fictional Coburg Square. Don't look for it. It doesn't exist, or it doesn't exist where they're talking about, near St. Paul's in London. Quote, "A pokey little shabby genteel place where four lines of dingy two-storied brick houses looked out into a small railed-in enclosure where a lawn of weedy grass and a few clumps of faded laurel bushes make a hard fight against a smoke-laden and uncongenial atmosphere." That's 1891. Where, what, 134 years later? Now, that would be a des res and cost a lot of money. I was recently observing that near Caledonia Market, for example, you can see this in the pricing policies of housing. Now, what I'd like to do at this last point is to say that I think you might argue that I've been pessimistic. I wouldn't see that myself. I would always argue that I'm being realistic. But what is clearly the case is that the urban history of the country cannot be understood if one isn't aware of other aspects of its history, whether it is, as with the Blitz, military history, whether it is political, whether it's economic, social, etc., etc. All of these are of consequence, and all of these need to be addressed. To my mind, and again, people may disagree, but to my mind, talking about the towns today is rather like talking about public health. It is not really much point discussing what people might or might not wish for the National Health Service or for the town centre of one town or the other, unless you have the economic growth to produce the wherewithal to do that, and unless you produce appropriate economic circumstances to encourage investment. At the present moment, there seems to be little room for optimism on these points. So that unless the economy is improved, one could anticipate a larger number of people, a significant percentage of them being recent migrants, but many not, a larger number of people living in towns, many of them having living standards and living circumstances which are not what they had wished for or anticipated, and with both the standards and the circumstances under pressure. Others may choose to see this in an optimistic light. I see very little basis for that.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. That's a somber note to draw this epic history of English towns to a close. I want to start by just asking a couple of questions, if I may. And that is, I mean, we see at the moment many, many towns really struggling, particularly market towns, towns in the Midlands and the North struggling. A few key towns and cities really becoming hotspots, like Oxford, Cambridge, Bath, London, and London as ever, of course. But there seems to be increasingly in the last 20, 30 years, a concentration in a few cities of wealth and opportunity, and a hollowing out in other towns and cities. Looking at this from a historical perspective, could we say this is any different to how it's always been?
Well, no, I think it's very difficult to know how best to measure those. But if you're talking in qualitative terms, you're absolutely right. In qualitative terms, there have always been, as we've discussed, some towns that did better than others. And there have always been changes in functions. Go back to the Romans, where I live in Exeter, was a legionary fortress for a brief period and then ceased to be one. Some towns that were dioceses, diocesan centres, for example, Crediton, lost that position. I think we discussed that when we were looking at the early modern economy into the 18th century, Bristol and Norwich were very major centres, but by 1830, both of them had been long passed by other rising cities such as Manchester. So it's not new. But I think what we're talking about at the present moment is when we're referring to hollowing out. I think in the case of some cities and some towns, the scale of the decline is really very significant. And I'm not quite sure that it matches a culture that at the present moment is used to the idea that if adversity happens, as in COVID or feeling unwell or feeling depressed, everybody throws resources at you.
I suppose one other difference between now and taking the long view is that often we've seen towns come into their own because they find themselves close to a very useful source, be it coal or good water to set up breweries or tanning or whatever. There was a geographical reason which got tapped economically, and the town nearest to these resources prospered. As we've moved into a post-industrial economy, particularly over the last 30 years, although for much longer, it seems to me that the opportunity for some towns to grow is not obviously there. Places which are attractive for middle class people to live in are going to do all right if they're within reach of London, but anywhere else has got a problem. Is that too bleak?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. That's very interesting. I mean, first of all, in the countryside, you had a situation where areas which are within, shall we say, 50 miles of a significant centre of employment or a major rail hub have generally done well, whereas areas that are more than 50 miles away, shall we say, West Shropshire, have done not so well. So the countryside itself has varied. As far as towns are concerned, there's a number of different paradoxes here. So that a lot of people took themselves and their money and their sense of the future they desired out of Britain into other parts of the European Union prior to Brexit. And you might argue that if you wish to talk about white flight from places like Redbridge, it occurred to Benidorm, for example, or Torremolinos, or coast. And if you want to look at it in a more affluent sense, you might say people left to go to the Dordogne. As far as I'm aware, that has become less the case. Because of the changes in residence requirements on the continent, but also I suspect because the economy hasn't been doing tremendously well. So that again creates interesting things. It is still the case that if you sell a property in London, you can purchase elsewhere. But on the other hand, the growth in the population and its relationship with what are perceived as attractive housing may well mean that there are fewer opportunities to move than people might have anticipated with the wealth they command.
Another key theme that you've discussed both in this episode and in different ways throughout the series has been the role of government, both local and central, in the fortunes of towns. We've gone through a period of what was seen to be centralization of government. Now we're going through a period of what was seen to be decentralization of government. But now, the latest news is, many district councils might be abolished and rolled into county councils because county councils are more likely to grant planning permission for new development than district councils. Where, again, taking kind of the long view on this, where are these developments? I mean, is this, again, the natural bobbing and flowing of centralization and decentralization? Or is something strange and against the rhythm of history happening in this century.
Well, I'm always a bit wary about the rhythm of history, other than a rhythm that is very uncertain. It seems to me that it tends to be monomaniacs who talk about history having a pattern, where a clear pattern of development, which, what a surprise, is usually the pattern that they wish it to go in. You know, that was sort of the feature that you associated with Mr. Blair, for example. Let's just simply argue that the role of government has become more potent because the non-state part of the economy and of employment is under pressure, is more modest around much of the country, and is more under state regulation. That you see this more obviously in those areas where the percentage of state employees is highest or higher. Scotland is a good example of that compared to, shall we say, Wiltshire. But that in a way, this is not attractive because it means that politics becomes a matter, and the wider politics of people complaining and all the rest of it, becomes a matter of screaming and shouting to get the state to do what they want in order to get it to provide for them. And this kind of process is one in which towns then become building blocks, because the towns then also try and return to the government the political support that the government wants in terms of electoral votes, or in terms of agreeing to take a certain number of migrants, or to agree to take to build a certain number of houses. And there are often what one might regard as corrupt, maybe going too far, but I think corrupting bargains between town councils, planners and central government, in which in return for taking those sort of things, you then in turn receive money for, quote, development. So you can take any view on this that you like. So I'm not quite sure that I would see pattern, but insofar as the country does appear to be in quite rapid relative decline, and in a measure of absolute decline in many aspects of the circumstances of life, and then insofar as that is the case, then those are going to become most pressing and most obvious in towns that have economic difficulties.
Well, as I say, a somber note to end, but an important and challenging one. I think we've had over 20, 21 episodes of this history of English towns, taking us from through the first millennium right up into the 21st century. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you. And I hope people have an opportunity to listen and to pass them on. And obviously, no historian is offering a definitive account. That is a flawed and foolish assumption. But what I've tried to do is to provide a narrative and an analysis which is not based on the idea that later is obviously better. I think that is facile, and I think unfortunately it characterises all too much of public debate.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.